Next question.
What, Chuck?
I'm sitting here watching the press conference. Nice suit.
Thank you, Chuck. I'm busy right now.
I need some socks. I need them for my footsies. About 6 to 10 pair.
Chuck, I gotta go.
Hey, give me them socks!
You're listening to Banal of America Audio.
Many, many years ago, I was doing a story then for the New York Times on Moses Malone. Moses was shifting from the ABA to the NBA. And my first question was an incredibly intricate question. It went on for 3 to 4 minutes with thousands of clauses.
There's a problem.
And I was trying to get him to be incredibly introspective.
What did he say? What's his answer?
His exact answer to me, which I've remembered for 35 years, was, that's what bees. That's it.
I love that answer.
That's it.
That says it all.
It sounds like you were pretty, I mean, some of the stories about your gambling is just intense. I mean, like, there are some people that think that you ended up betting on the NBA because you got so in debt that you sort of had to turn to that as a last resort. But, I mean, maybe you, obviously you'd know better than anybody. So was it sort of like, was it just that it was just so easy that why wouldn't you bet on it? You were so, I guess you could say, like, such a gambling junkie that it didn't even matter to you anymore? Or was it sort of like a desperation thing where you needed the you know, the safe bet?
No, it wasn't a desperation thing at all. I was making close to $300,000 a year, and I wasn't a big bettor. I was just, an addicted gambler. And when you talk about an addiction, you talk about doing things that you rationally know are wrong, but for whatever reason, you do them anyway. And, I wanted to bet on anything and everything that I could. And with the knowledge that I had, I was sucked in. And with my buddy, I just wanted to be the man and show him that, you know, these things were predictable and I passed along the information to him and he just was, in a position where he couldn't believe that it was so predictable and, you know, I continued to pass along the information to him.
Now, this is your buddy that you became friends with at the country club and everything else, right?
Yes, Jack.
Yeah. I presume that relationship's over now. Based on just the way things shook out, right?
It is. I mean, I haven't had any conversations with him. He was basically, for whatever reason, let off the hook and never prosecuted with the rest of us. But, that's something that, I wouldn't wish on anybody, knowing what it did and how it destroyed my family. But it was a situation where I haven't had any contact with him.
Yeah, it's unfortunate in that regard, because it sounded like you guys were pretty good friends and everything. So.
Yeah, we were.
Have you talked to the two guys from when you were in your high school days? Did you have any interaction with them when all this, after this all went down and everything?
No, I haven't had any interaction with them. It's a situation where, because of probation, you're restricted from talking to other convicted felons. I know Batista and Martino were actually put in the same Brooklyn jail, and then, Batista had... basically put a hit out on Martino in the jail for somebody to do some harm to him because he kind of cooperated along the same lines that I did. So they ended up moving Martino out of that jail and putting him in a different jail in Boston, Massachusetts. So, I don't see that the three of us would have any conversations now or in the future with the way everything went down.
Yeah. At the end of the book, I thought it was interesting that you endorse Mark Cuban as a potential future NBA commissioner, which I thought was interesting because it sounded like his relationships with the referees were sort of ran hot and cold, depending on who the referee was, and that the league certainly didn't really like him very much because he was sort of like the squeaky wheel. But I guess talk a little bit about Mark Cuban and why you think that he'd make a good commissioner for the NBA eventually.
Well, I think that Mark Cuban is one of those guys that just wants the rules enforced based on how they're written in the rule book, no matter what they are. And it's a situation where he wants to build his team and his coaching staff around the rules and put himself in the best position to win. And when you talk about having a set of rules that aren't being enforced, it just creates a lot of confusion for everybody. And he's just one of those guys that... is adamant about enforcing the rules based upon how they're written. And I think, that's what the fans need to know is taking place so that they have, some confidence that the product on the floor is a situation that is fair for everybody.
Now, I know that in the book you say that the referees talk about, like, everything, that they sort of gossip about everything. Now, one famous sort of conspiracy theory surrounding the NBA is that Michael Jordan, when he left to play baseball, was secretly suspended for gambling, which ironically enough, obviously was your forte. So did you ever hear that story, and what do you make of that whole conspiracy theory?
It's certainly something that was discussed amongst you know, referees and team personnel with referees that he was you know, sent on a you know, basically a year away from the game because of his gambling habits to try and get his you know, self together so that wouldn't be exposed. So you know, there's no concrete evidence that was what had happened, but it certainly was openly discussed about you know, how he and David Stern came to a conclusion that he was going to step away from the game for a while until things calmed down.
Interesting. Okay. Yeah, I'm sure it would be sort of the hard thing, a hard sort of thing to get any concrete evidence on, I'm sure, if it was, especially if it was some kind of backroom deal.
Right. I mean, there's probably two people that know about it, and one's Michael Jordan, who's now an owner, and David Stern, who's the commissioner. So I don't think it's a situation where either one of them are going to come up and say that it happened.
Yeah. Now, what about the other big conspiracy theory is the Knicks winning the draft lottery there, and a lot of people think that there was some chicanery involved in that. Did you ever hear that whole story? And you know, what was the consensus among the referees on that whole thing? I know that was a little bit before your time as a referee.
It was slightly before my time, but you know, of course, it was openly discussed that you know, that one envelope was put in the freezer before you know, the whole draft lottery, so that when he stuck his hand in there, he could find it real easy. So, you know, it certainly was openly discussed, but as to whether it actually happened or not, you know, I have no idea. But, you know, a lot of things that have happened over the course of the last 15 or 20 years in the NBA are kind of strange, and when you throw them all together, you know, you really have to sit back and say, how can this all happen?
Yeah. Well, on that note, what other sort of strange things have you heard that maybe I haven't come across before as far as these weird sort of occurrences?
I think, you know, most of them is just in these playoff series, how, you know, a lot of these playoff series turn around and somebody like L.A. comes back and wins and is given the benefit of an enormous amount of free throws and calls in the fourth quarter in these games. And, you know, it's just situations that when you really sit back and look at them, you know, you can't believe they take place, but yet the NBA tries to stand behind the fact that, you know, it was just a few missed calls by the officials.
Yeah, but really it speaks to something larger than that, right?
Right.
Now, what about this year's NBA Finals? Was there any chicanery, you think, involved in that? I'm a Boston fan, Boston born and raised, so you know, I'm obviously biased myself on this, but I know you closely watched the NBA Finals and posted about it at Deadspin. So, you know, what did you think about how it all played out?
I mean, I think it played out. It was, you know, basically a situation where the NBA, you know, couldn't have planned it any better. A seven-game series, two of the big market teams in there. And, you know, I just think that it was a situation where, you know, the referees didn't do as good a job as they probably could have, but you know, it just seemed like LA seemed to get a lot of the benefit of a lot of calls in the right situations, and you know Boston struggled at times, and you know, it was a situation where LA just won.
Let's talk a little bit about some of these various superstars. What kind of interaction did you have with Shaq?
You know, Shaq was one of those, you know, fun-loving guys that really at times didn't give the referees a hard time. It would just let you know that, you know, people paid an enormous amount of money to see him on the floor and not to be calling cheap fouls on him.
I thought it was interesting in the book that you note that he asked them to deflate the ball a little bit for him, and they did, which I thought was kind of interesting because obviously that's probably not allowed.
There has to be a certain amount of air pressure in the ball, and before the game, a lot of times he would come up to the referees and ask them to get a needle and let some air out, which would, you know, allow that little soft touch of his around the basket or with the free throws to allow the you know, the ball to get into that hoop just a little bit easier.
Now, what about Charles Barkley? You have a great story in there about Charles Barkley and a bucket of ice. Tell that story for folks so I don't ruin it for them.
Yeah, it was a situation where during the game he was giving me some heat, and I gave him a technical foul, and he was all over me, and Rudy Tomjanovich came up to me and said that you know, the technical foul is unwarranted. Charles wouldn't complain like that if he was right. And I basically ended up having a bet with Rudy Tomjanovich, for a dinner over who was right and who was wrong at the end of the game. We both looked at the play on a videotape, and Rudy admitted that I was right and went in and gave Charles some grief over it. And, you know, I went into the shower, and Charles came into the locker room and emptied the drinks out of a big container of Gatorade and ice and threw it all over me and kind of, you know, got his jollies off and pranced out of there laughing because I guess that was his way of getting even with me, because Rudy went in and gave him some grief.
Yeah, and I thought it was interesting that in the book you say that, you know, you could have made a lot of trouble for Barkley after that and gotten him in a bunch of trouble with the league, but it was sort of like better to just to play ball, no pun intended, and, you know, that way he'd sort of be indebted to you, wouldn't give you as much of a hard time in the future, right?
It was a situation where I let it go, and the next time I saw him, he kind of winked at me and thanked me and knew that I let him off the hook and probably saved him a big fine and a suspension, and he kind of backed off and laid off me, and he was one of those players that was really tough on referees, especially young referees, so it really helped me a lot.
Yeah, interesting. See, these are the kind of things, like you say, the game within the game. It's really fascinating stuff. Now, what about Kobe Bryant? You say in the book that he's sort of like the new Jordan, if you will, that his style of interaction with the referees was a lot different from Jordan's, and that Jordan sort of, I think you intimate in the book that he wasn't, you know, sort of in your face about calls and stuff, but Kobe Bryant was a lot different.
Yeah, I mean, Kobe's somebody that, you know, definitely will let you know that he's the marquee player in the league at this time, and he should be playing by a different set of rules, and during free throws and during timeouts, he's going to definitely approach you and let you know that he feels that he's not getting the benefit of those star treatment calls. And he's somebody that's very adamant about, getting on the referees if he feels like he's not getting that star treatment.
And what's, like, when you're a referee, what's the reaction to that sort of thing? Is it sort of like you have to begrudgingly accept that they're right in the sense that within the framework of the way the league is that they're right, even though they're wrong within the sense of the rules?
There's no doubt about it, and you know, he ends up working the referees, especially some of the younger referees, and you know, a lot of the veteran referees will fall for that too, and he'll end up getting to the free throw line on cheap marginal plays that are going to be let go for somebody else, and it's a situation in the NBA where the squeaky wheel gets the oil, whether it's the players or it's the coaches, and they're very well aware of that, and you know, like you said, it's a game within the game of working the referees.
Now, this past NBA Finals, we did see that Kobe Bryant got fouled out in the second game. Now, do you think that was sort of like them making a statement that the star treatment isn't totally predictable sort of thing?
Well, I mean, I think it's a situation where my book had come out, and, you know, it's one of those things where they're trying to, act like it doesn't happen, but, you know, it certainly does, and it depends on what group of referees are out on the floor that night, if they're going to have the guts to enforce the rules, the way they're written, and it also depends on, a situation on who's up and who's down in the series, and I think that was a situation where L.A. had won the first game, so it wasn't, going to be a big deal if they had lost the second game and he had fouled out, because it would be tied one game apiece.
Yeah. Now, what about LeBron James? You don't seem to mention him too much in the book. What was your interaction like with him as a player?
He was kind of quiet and really didn't complain much. He was still young when I was in the league, so, it wasn't a point where he was the marquee player that he is today. So I'm sure he's a lot more vocal out on the floor today than he was, 3 years ago.
It seems that way, yeah. Yeah, it seems that way. Now, what do you make of... I'm sure you're still an NBA fan, so, I mean, what do you make of him leaving Cleveland, going to Miami, and this sort of triumvirate of stars that's forming down in Miami?
Yeah, I kind of think that it's not right. You know, he was drafted by Cleveland. They were going to give him more money than what he had gotten in Miami, and I just find that... it's a situation where it's the league allowed that to happen. It's a situation where it's another, bigger market team, Miami over Cleveland, getting the benefit of, three star players. And it's what's, good for the league, and you know, it's most likely going to be a situation where you're going to have Miami and LA in the finals this coming year.
That seems to be the case. Yeah, that seems to be the case. And you'd think that just based on what we've established here in this conversation with the culture of bias as far as star players go, you know, that's going to be a very difficult team to beat for some of these you know, small market teams or teams without any stars.
No, there's no doubt about it. I mean, you have three of the top players in the game in Bosch, Wade, and LeBron on the floor, and they're going to be very difficult to defend. And, you know, let alone the fact that, you know, they're going to play by a different set of rules than some of the other players are going to be playing by. So they're going to be very difficult to beat. And, you know, it's a situation where, you know, some of these small market teams are going to be, you know, hard to you know, get some wins when they play some of these teams. And then I think you see it now where Chris Paul wants to you know, be traded immediately because he doesn't feel that he has any shot at all winning where he's at.
Yeah. Now, do you think this is says something about the league sort of changing in a way where it's like maybe as opposed to sort of like the superstar players taking it for granted that they got preferential treatment or whatever, now they're sort of like using it even more to their advantage?
Yeah, I think they are certainly using it more to their advantage. But, you know, there's a situation where there's a set of rules in place so that, you know, some of these teams can keep these star players. And for whatever reason, you know, it's almost like they're colluding together to all go to one team when they're not supposed to be. So, you know, obviously, you know, the system that they have in place is not working.
Absolutely, yeah, that's for sure. Now, what about Phil Jackson? What kind of interaction did you have with him?
Phil Jackson was one of those people that wasn't a big yeller, screamer, cursor. He was just one of those guys that would make some sarcastic statements to you as you ran up and down the floor to try to get the benefit of the calls from you. And, you know, he was good at, you know, playing that game within the game with the referees. But, you know, for the most part, he wasn't, you know, one of those real yellers and screamers like a Larry Brown or Jerry Sloan.
I find it interesting that he does a lot of sort of mind games, like in the press conferences and stuff before the series starts. Especially you saw a lot this playoff series where he sort of plants the seed in the referees' minds to closely watch certain players and stuff like that.
Well, I mean, he's one of the masters, and he uses the media to get his messages across, not only to the league office, but to the referees to look for certain things. And when something hits the media like that, he knows the referees read the newspapers just like everybody else. So if he brings it up, maybe it's a point of emphasis that it will jump out at a referee, you know, a little bit quicker and a little bit faster than some other things. So he, you know, he plays those mind games, and it obviously has helped him along the years.
Now, talk a little bit about the story that you have in the book about Jeff Van Gundy and the playoff series there against the Mavericks, and how there was like some inside information that got funneled out and then got out into the press, and it really could have been a huge scandal, but the NBA kind of covered the whole thing up. So I guess talk a little bit about that, because that was, you know, that's almost the closest we have to some kind of tangible proof about what really is going on.
Right. I believe it was in 2005. Houston was up 2-0 on Dallas with the series moving to Houston, and I was an alternate referee in Game 3. And Mark Cuban was launching an enormous amount of complaints about certain things. And, you know, I was in a meeting, and they showed videotape, and they basically said that they wanted illegal screens and traveling called on Yao Ming. Because of the complaints by Mark Cuban, and if he so much as moved his pivot foot a little bit while setting a screen or you know, making a move to the basket, they wanted the violation called on him. And, you know, it was a situation where the referees knew that, you know, the league office wanted Dallas to come back in the series, and Dallas won the next 2 games and ended up winning in Game 7.
Yeah, it seems like the league really has it out for Mark Cuban in a way. I guess talk a little bit about how Van Gundy sort of revealed the inside information and then the NBA covered it up.
He did. He basically was getting the information that the referees were going to make these calls from the group supervisor on the series, who was Don Vaden, who had talked to him by telephone a number of times. And, you know, had told him that this was going to take place, and he just became frustrated that he lost the next 2 games and went public and said a league official told him that they were going to concentrate on calling certain things on Yao Ming. And, you know, he was fined $100,000 because he wouldn't reveal what league official told him. But I knew it was Don Vaden because he had told me that he had talked to him several times on the telephone. So, you know, it was something that the league came out a couple days later and said that Jeff Van Gundy misspoke and he had never talked to a league official, which was, you know, just their way of covering it up.
Yeah. Now, you say that the result of the FBI investigation did sort of yield some sort of suspect individuals, but that the FBI didn't really follow up on them. What do you make of that whole thing?
I think it was a situation where, you know, the NBA is very powerful and certain things, you know, weren't going to be revealed in this whole investigation because, you know, they just wanted to paint me as the one bad apple and have this thing brushed away as quickly as possible. And I think that they were able to accomplish that.
Now, in light of what you know, do you think that you were the only one sort of like mixed up in funneling out inside information, or is this something you think that actually, you know, is a more prevalent occurrence?
Well, the information that was passed along to me was that they had no information that other referees were betting on games, but the information was so easily obtainable and certainly discussed by so many different people that, you know, there's no way that it wasn't passed along by other referees.
Yeah. Talk a little bit about the female referees, because I thought this was a really interesting aspect of the book, too, that, you know, I'd always noticed the one female referee that's still around and wondered kind of like how she ended up even in the NBA, but you sort of lay out how she and another female official ended up becoming referees for the NBA, and I just found that kind of interesting, because you don't see any female umpires or female, you know, football referees or anything like that.
It was a situation where there was one woman who wanted to pursue the fact of being an NBA referee, and I guess there were some deflammatory reports written about her that were discovered, and she ended up suing the league for sexual discrimination. And while that whole lawsuit was going on, the NBA went out and found the two top college referees in the women's game and actually hired them on the NBA staff quicker than you could ever imagine, you know, to help with that lawsuit. And I think that the woman originally won an enormous amount of money, and then the NBA appealed it. And, you know, she was just given her attorney fees in a settlement. So it was very strange how they and why they were hired. But, you know, they certainly weren't the top qualified candidates to be hired at the time.
Yeah, you make the case that, you know, the NBA could bring in really qualified college officials, but they don't want to take the pay cut or something like that as far as or deal with the headaches of being an NBA referee.
Right, and you go, when you really look at certain things, you know, how do you, you know, when you want to hire the most qualified referees to bring them into the NBA, how is it possible that you can go and hire two college referees out of the women's game when you have an enormous amount of, you know, male referees at the top of the college game where, you know, the women's game is just so much slower, and even the male college game is so much slower than the NBA that you go and find two female referees out of nowhere and hire them onto the staff. It just was very strange.
I guess talk a little bit about your decision to cooperate with the FBI. Like, when did you, obviously I know this because I've read the book, but how did you come to the decision to, you know, stop running, I guess you could say, and just play ball with the FBI as you knew they were kind of starting to look at at what you've been doing?
Well, it was a situation where, you know, I had gone to an attorney because I knew there were some grand jury hearings that were being convened. And my attorney actually spoke to the United States attorney, and he basically just, you know, told my attorney to give me a message. And that message was that he knew what I did and when I did it and who I did it with. And it was just a matter of time before they came and got me. And I was much better off losing my job rather than losing my job for a long, long time. So I needed to make a decision as to whether I wanted to talk to them immediately or whether I just wanted to wait and see what happened. And I thought it was in my best interest and in my family's best interest for me to go to them and talk to them immediately.
Now, as this thing was like about to break, did you have any realization of just how massive this story was going to turn out to be once it all got out into the press?
No, I didn't. I think I was a little bit naive, you know, with how it was all going to play out. And I think that I got a clear dose of reality when You know, there were several hundred news vans parked outside my house waiting for me to come out. So, you know, it was something I thought and hoped would die down, but it certainly didn't. And, you know, even to this day, you know, I get an enormous amount of requests for interviews in regard to the story about what I did and how I did it. So, you know, that was one of the thoughts behind writing the book and putting it out there so that people could really have a good understanding.
Yeah, yeah. How'd you feel about the coverage of it all? I mean, you were like wall to wall all over the ESPN and everything else for quite a while when all this went down. Like watching it, you know, as the player in the whole thing, and then watching it on TV. How'd you feel about the coverage? I mean, I'm sure you were crucified in a lot of places. So, I mean, what was that like?
You know, it was sickening because you know you basically have to look in the mirror and admit that you certainly made some terrible and dumb choices. And, you know, not only did those choices affect you, but they affected the people that you love the most, and that's your family. And when you talk about the disappointment that I, you know, caused my mother and father and my kids and my ex-wife, it's something where, you know, you certainly wish you could go back and turn back time, but we all know that you can. And unfortunately for me, I think about it every night when I put my head on the pillow and I wake up wishing it was a nightmare, but it's certainly not. It's reality. So I'm trying to turn a very negative situation into somewhat of a positive situation and sharing my story with others and hoping that they realize how, you know, terrible choices can affect us all. So, you know, to stay away from, you know, crossing that line.
Absolutely. Yeah. Now talk about the difficult conversation you had with your dad when you told him about all this, because I know he was a referee in the college level, you know, so it was sort of like a generational thing, and you know, he was profoundly disappointed about what happened. So I guess talk a little bit about how difficult that was.
Believe it or not, it was Father's Day 2007, and I called him to wish him a happy Father's Day, and he sensed a tone in my voice to where something was wrong, and he kept pressing me, and it, you know, was a situation where I just broke down and told him what I had done. And, you know, like any father that would support their son or daughter, he basically told me that, you know, obviously it was a poor choice, but he was going to stand by me and help me any way that he could, and he did. You know, and so did my mother, and they still do to this day. So, you know, I'm very fortunate that I have a great family and a good circle of friends that I'm still in touch with that have supported me and hopefully are going to see me back on my feet soon.
Did he ever put the picture back up?
No, he didn't put the picture back up. And, you know, and I kind of don't blame him. It's a reminder of, you know, what I did, you know, to you know, the situation that I was basically, you know, involved with and the great job that I had. So, you know, it's a situation where, you know, that article that was in the newspaper that was in the frame, you know, never went back up on the wall, and rightfully so.
Talk a little bit about life in prison. You know, I know you were, not to revisit this too much, but I know that you, you know, fell victim to, you know, an attack. Was that motivated, you think, by legitimate sort of nefarious forces, or was it more just some guy trying to make a name for himself, you know, in the prison yard?
Well, I think it's a situation where, you know, when you're going into a federal prison and you're a cooperating witness and it's plastered all over the news that, you know, I was a little naive that, you know, people weren't going to really know about that. And you know, there's people that have been in prison for a long, long time because somebody cooperated against them. So, you know, right away I was labeled a rat and, you know, nobody wanted to hang with me or talk to me. And, you know, then you get some nut that, like you said, wants to make a name for himself and claim that he's associated with organized crime and wants to attack me. And that's basically what happened.
Now, but you do say that when the whole story broke that you did get like a threatening phone call. Were you threatened, you know, by nefarious people out there or even the NBA, you know, about all this?
You know, there were times where I did receive some threats, and, you know, even to this day, I've met with local FBI agents here that, you know, are just, you know, briefing me on the surroundings of this area and, you know, knowing that, you know, when I do go out that I have to be aware of where I'm at and who's around me and just to have a mindset that, you know, to know where my surroundings are. So, you know, it's something that I certainly aren't going to live my life in fear constantly, but it has to be in the back of my mind just to, you know, be made aware of, you know, where I'm at and what I'm doing.
Yeah, yeah. That must wear on you after a while, though, I'm sure.
It does, but hopefully over time it's something that will wear a little bit less.
Absolutely, yeah. You know, that's the hope, right?
Yep.
What do you think needs to be done in the wake of your revelations as far as the NBA goes?
You know, I think that they need to hire the most qualified referees that they can get. I think that they have to allow the referees to enforce the rules based on how they're written in the rule book and, you know, not referee certain personalities or big market teams and have the fans realize that everybody's being treated the same way and that moving forward it's going to be a true athletic competition and not a form of entertainment.
There were some allegations that the NBA tried to squash your book or keep it from being published. I know on the back of the book it says, quotes Deadspin, says the book the NBA doesn't want you to read. What kind of hassle did you get from the NBA when you were putting the book out?
I did have a contract with Triumph Publishing, which was an imprint of Random House, and I think about 2 weeks or a week before the book was actually supposed to hit the shelves, it was vetted by Triumph. They were very, very excited. They flew out to New York and discussed the book with FBI agents and were, you know, very confident that everything in the book was true. And, you know, right before it was supposed to come out, some league representatives had some meetings with people at Random House, and at the last minute they canceled the book. And, you know, we were told that there were threats of lawsuits, and, you know, the NBA league officials also went in to discuss, you know, the airing of the 60 Minutes episode, but, you know, they didn't quite listen or weren't scared away as quickly as Random House was.
I know in the book you say the NBA was chasing you down for restitution on your salary and everything like that. How did that all shake out?
Well, you know, it's a situation where I owe them $200,000. The judge ordered that prior to, you know, the book coming out and just with, you know, what they had, you know, threw out in court. They tried to get $1.4 million from me, and the judge lowered it down to about $200,000. And to this day, anything that I make, you know, a major portion of it goes towards that restitution.
Oh, like all profits from the book and stuff like that?
Profits from the book or whatever job that I may work or whatever until that restitution's paid off, you know, that the government continues to, you know, track my income.
Yeah. When you were sort of like under the thumb of this of Batista, who's the guy who claimed to have mafia ties and everything like that, you thought you kind of could get out from under it eventually. Did you think about just sort of like making bad picks over and over again, or was it sort of the thing where you were in kind of danger of being, you know, your family being hurt or something crazy happening to you if you didn't play ball?
Yeah, it was a situation where I just, you know, had hoped to give them the winning picks that they were getting behind my back prior, and just at the end of the season, you know, being a situation where it was just all forgotten and, you know, that I was never going to do it again. And I thought the best way to do that was to continue to provide them with winning picks and hope that it would all go away. And unfortunately, you know, that's not the way it all unfolded.
Well, you do make the case. I don't know if it was you that made the case or if it was Mark Cuban or someone else that thinks that the referees should be sort of like a wholly independent organization apart from the NBA. That's that way there wouldn't be this kind of collusion. Is that even possible, do you think, or is that something the NBA would never let happen?
I don't think it's something that the NBA would ever let happen because that would, you know, take a lot of control, you know, out of their hands, and they have, you know, seem to be able to control everything. So, you know, I think that it would be the best scenario for everybody involved, but I just don't think that that's a possibility at this time.
Yeah, yeah, it seems that way because they want to make sure that what they want to happen happens, I guess, right?
Right.
I found it interesting, too, that when you first start in the NBA, they have like a new rule going on, and then the referees sort of like stop enforcing the rule because it was ruining the flow of the game or something like that. I just found it kind of interesting that it's like even though you're under the auspices of the NBA, there's still quite a bit of control going on out there where the referees, if they don't want to enforce the rules, they won't.
No, I mean, certain, like I said before, certain referees, you know, enforce certain rules and certain referees don't. And it's just the subjectivity about, you know, who the referee is and how many years of experience and whether he referees in the NBA Finals or not is whether the league comes down and reprimands him or not. And, you know, hand-checking is a prime example. Some people enforce it and some referees don't. They feel like it's a deterrent. And, you know, it hurts the game. It slows the game down. So it's a situation where they need to get all these referees on the same page and have them enforce the rules based upon how they're written in the book.
Now, let's say somebody's watching an NBA game. You know, they've heard this interview and they're watching an NBA game. What kind of stuff should they be looking for as, you know, signs of the game within the game being played?
Well, I think that, you know, right now a lot of that stuff is probably going to be taken out of the league. But, you know, certainly you can see how coaches and players will yell and scream at a referee. And the next time down the floor, that referee will give that team a call or that player a call. And, you know, it was obvious this year. I saw it happen a lot in the playoffs. And I think if you really look for that, when a coach like Doc Rivers screams at a referee, you know, the next time down the floor, you know, if he screams at him again, he'll most likely get a call to get, that referee to get him off his back.
Now, I noticed, too, during the playoffs this year that, and I'm sure you'll know this, that now they have some kind of, like, instant replay in the last minute or something like that. When did that come about? And, you know, what was the reasoning behind that? And how do you think that affects the culture of bias?
I think that it's gonna help it in regard to that. You know, referees will now know that you know, there's a system in place that you know, will embarrass them if they're out there making the wrong calls or letting some other influence affect what they're going to call. So I think it's a situation where it's certainly going to help the game and help the league and help the fans think that things can be overturned if they're not correct. So I think you're going to see little by little more of that take place.
Now, was this something that came about as a result of your whole of what happened with you?
You know what? I'm not sure. I think it was new this year, and I'm not sure why it became you know, a part of the game. So you know, it's a situation where I'm not really you know, in the inside anymore, knowing why these things are taking place.
Yeah. Yeah. Does seem sort of ironic, though, don't you?
Sure, absolutely.
Yeah, but you know, in a way, it's probably good because it keeps that sort of thing in check. But I can't imagine that they'd ever expand it to like the full game or anything crazy like that.
I think it would just slow it down too much. I think at some point there might be a situation where you know, just like in the NFL, a coach can throw a red flag out onto the floor and allow the play to be you know, reviewed, and if he's right that he can keep his time out and the call can be overturned. I think you know, sometime in the future you may see something like that.
Yeah, that seems like that might be the case eventually. All right, well, the books, you know, you're back in society, you're on probation, but you're back out there now. What are you up to nowadays aside from promoting the book? You know, what have you been up to?
You know, I'm you know, in a situation where I'm giving some speeches, trying to share my story with some people that suffer from gambling addictions, and hopefully get on the you know, college campus tour to where you know, I can let people know that we certainly have those choices to make in life and how important they are to make the right ones, and talk about, you know, ethics and how I certainly was at the top of my game, but because of some poor decisions that I made that, you know, I basically hit rock bottom and I'm starting to come back on my feet with the help of some good friends and a great family. So, you know, I think that there's a story to be told out there and I'm hoping to share it.
And do you think this culture of bias in the NBA, do you think it's going to ever go away, or is it sort of just going to fade into the background now for a while, but it'll still be there?
I think it's going to kind of fade away a little bit, but I think there's always going to be somewhat of a bias in the game. But, you know, as far as widespread as it was before, I think it's certainly going to, you know, shrink an enormous amount.
Now, obviously, you heard, you know, positive things from people from the book, so you think that, you know, it's resonating at least hopefully in some of the higher channels at the NBA.
There's no doubt about it. I've got a very positive, you know, response to the book because of the message that's in the book. I know a lot of people want to read about the, you know, the stuff about the NBA, but I think it's also a great message there about the choices that we all have to make, and I think that you know, that's what's really grabbing a lot of people's attention.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, the stuff about the about the games and the stars and the coaches and the owners and stuff. I mean, that's fascinating and glamorous and stuff, but the true story of, you know, your descent is gripping. And I mean, I can't put it over enough. Like I said, I read the book in about a day and a half. It was that engaging. So, I mean, I got to give you credit for that. It was quite a story. And I mean, I know that a lot of people in the sports world are quick to sort of, you know, crucify you and throw you under the bus here and just keep, you know, labeling you as disgrace and all that stuff. But I mean, I got to give you credit for trying to turn this thing into a positive, at least, you know what I mean? And trying to tell your story about what happened and expose what's really going on in the NBA with this culture of bias. So, you know, I wish you the best of luck and hats off to you, for stepping up and taking responsibility for what happened and what you did and trying to get on with your life and help other people through it.
Well, I appreciate that very much. It means a lot.
And, you know, it's been great talking to you. You've given us just a ton of information here and hopefully pulled the curtain back a little bit on the NBA for the fans who are listening. And you know, like I said at the beginning of the show, we've had a lot of people on here who allege conspiracy and stuff like that, but we've never had anybody on who was sort of like right in the mix of it. So to provide that kind of perspective is really invaluable. And I can't thank you enough for coming on the show, Tim.
Anytime. I appreciate it.
That does it for this week's edition of BOA Audio Season 5. Big, big, super huge thanks, of course, to Tim Donaghy for coming on the show. You can find out more about his story via his book, Personal Foul, a first-person account of the scandal that rocked the NBA. Just punch in Personal Foul in Amazon.com or BarnesandNoble.com. You'll be able to find it there. Or just go down to your bookstore. I'm sure they have it on their shelves. And all the great folks out there who are first-time listeners to the program, checked out this interview with Tim Donaghy because they were interested in his story. Hopefully some of you stick around. Hopefully some of you dig into the BOA Audio Archive and check out some of our previous interviews and episodes. If you're into the paranormal, you are in for a treat because we cover just about everything under the sun in the world of the strange and mysterious. So dig on into BOA Audio. Stick around for our upcoming episodes because we've got some great stuff on tap. And shoot me an email if you're a first-time listener and you've discovered us and you're getting into the program. Love to hear from you. Speaking of which, of course, it is now time for BOA Audio listener feedback. But since this episode is way overdue and I want to get it out to people as fast as possible, plus I want to in turn get started on next week's edition of the program, let's eschew BOA Audio listener feedback this time around. That said, of course, I do want to hear from all the folks out there, whether you're first-time listeners or long-time listeners of the program. Here are the methods to get in touch with me. You can just go to banalofamerica.com, B-I-N-N-A-L-L of America.com, and click the contact button, or punch in boaaudio@hotmail.com to your email machine, and that'll get an email off to me in no time flat. Or you can join up at the official BOA forum, theusofe.com, theusofe.com. Great group of folks on there talking about the paranormal, the esoteric, and pop culture as well. Quite a fun community, and we're always welcoming newcomers to our little gang there at the US of E. We like to call it BOA's Paranormal Playground. Come on over and join in on the conversations. And as I've been pointing out the last few weeks, you can always reach me via MySpace, Facebook, or Twitter. Just punch in Banal, B-I-N-N-A-L-L. Befriend me, follow me, poke me. It's all good. I want to hear feedback from all the great folks out there who tuned into this week's episode, who are looking forward to the remaining portions of the final four of Season 5. We've got some awesome stuff for you on tap in the next few weeks. I'll be talking a little bit about that in just a few moments. And we'll bring back BOA Audio listener feedback in full force next week. I'll try and do at least 3 emails because the mailbag is definitely overflowing here as we head towards the close of Season 5. Up next, it is the thanks portion of the show. Allow me to roll through the list of the esteemed and infamous BOA staff. Leslie, Chiron, Regan Lee, Joe V, Tina Senna, Rochelle Hawks, Richard Thomas, Marla Pena, our contributing cartoonist Andy Carolan, and our webmaster Jeremy Boston. It's been about 2 weeks since you've heard from me, so there's tons of stuff at Banal of America right now for your reading enjoyment. I could go down the list, but it would take us quite a while. I can tell you right now there's a couple of new editions of Gray Matters from Leslie. We've got Marla Pena weighing in on the previous edition of BOA Audio with Tony Kale talking about Santa Muerte, Mexico's mysterious saint of death. Marla Pena comes from Mexico and shares her perspective on the scene down there south of the border. Plus, we've got a fresh edition of Trickster's Realm from Regan Lee talking about invoking the memory synchronicities of retrieving missing time in eagle iconography. And just a throwback to Leslie's Gray Matter, she talks about Christopher Hitchens and his fight with cancer, as well as shares a really cool story about her very strange 4th of July. Those are two new Gray Matters from Leslie at BOA. And I think that covers the columns at the website for the last few weeks. Plus, we've got a couple of new editions of the Popcast Initiative, our pop culture podcast that I host with Jeremy Vaney. That thing is really taking off. We're getting a lot of great feedback from folks who are tuning into the Popcast Initiative and getting to see a whole different side of BOA and JV. I've been saying it all season long here at the end of the program, but it is true, my friends. If you're only listening to BOA audio and you're not reading the columns at Banal of America, then you're only getting half the story. BOA, make it a part of your everyday search for esoteric news and opinion. I know a lot of folks out there have been waiting quite a while for this week's edition of the program. Personally, I feel kind of like a slacker. I feel like a clown for taking so long to get this thing out to you. But I have to take side work to keep the whole operation going. I got to do a lot of little extra gigs to help make sure Banal of America stays up and running and freely available for all the great folks out there. And that's why here at the end of the program, every week we turn to you folks who have some disposable income and some change to throw in the bucket, and we ask you to make a donation to Banal of America. There's two ways to do it. You can just go to BOA and click the PayPal button. That'll bring you to PayPal. You can do one of those digital payment type deals. Very fast, very clean, very secure, and very simple to do. They'll walk you through the whole process. For the folks who don't trust the internet, they want to donate via snail mail. We've made that possible for you now. You can mail your donations to the following address. Tim Banal, B as in Boston, I-N-N-A-L-L, P.O. Box 232, Pinehurst, Mass. 01866. Let me roll through that one more time, getting a little more detailed for you. Tim Banal, P.O. Box 232, Pinehurst, spelled P-I-N-E-H-U-R-S-T, Mass. 01866. So all together again, that's Tim Banal, P.O. Box 232, Pinehurst, Mass. 01866. As always, no donation is too small, and all donations go towards Banal of America and BOA Audio to keep the entire franchise up and running, freely available, and commercial-free for all of our great readers and listeners the world over. Next week on the program, we continue onward with the final four of Season 5, guest number 2. We welcome legendary ufologist Dr. Bruce Maccabee in an interview that really is a long time coming. I'm stunned that we're all the way here into Season 5 and we're finally getting Dr. Bruce Maccabee on the program. He's been researching the UFO phenomenon since the late 1960s, and we're going to walk through his remarkable 40-plus year career chasing down the mystery of UFOs. We'll find out how he got into this, how his perspective on the phenomenon has changed over the years, some of the key cases he's investigated, his back-and-forth relationship with notable skeptic Phil Klass. We'll talk about photo analysis of UFOs and a whole bunch of other stuff. I haven't sat down to edit it yet, but I can tell you that it is really a remarkable conversation and definitely jam-packed with a ton of historical UFO information as well as insight into a number of critical cases surrounding this enigma. So that's Dr. Bruce Maccabee, guest number 2, in the final four of season five next week on BOA Audio. I promise you are not going to be waiting a very long time for that edition of the program, folks, because we are really only about 48 hours away from wrapping up principal recording of season five, meaning that there'll be no more interviews taped after this coming Monday. We will have all of the conversations for season five in the can, in the books, which means then I can sit down Monday night and just start pushing them out assembly line style. So I don't expect any more lengthy delays between the episodes as we move forward here in August. And I can tell you right now, because the season finale has already been taped, it is epic, my friends. I'm not going to reveal the guest's name right now, but if you go to Banal of America and just look at our logo, we've got an animated logo that I've been told essentially reveals who the season finale guest is. So head on over to BOA, take a look at the logo. It will animate itself for you, and you'll get an idea of who you'll be hearing from on Banal of America as we close the book on season five. And on that note, we close the book on this week's edition of the program. So let me once again thank Tim Donaghy for coming on the show and opening up and giving us so much information on the scandal that rocked the NBA. Thanks to all the great folks out there listening, the hardcore BOA audio listeners who stuck with this program, even though it is off the beaten path of what we normally discuss. And of course, thanks to all the great folks out there who are checking us out for the first time ever. I hope you enjoyed the program, and I hope you stick around for more BOA audio. And as we do here at the end of every program, super huge thanks to all of the great BOA audio listeners. Whether you tuned into this program or not, whether you skipped this episode or whether you checked it out, it's totally cool with me. If you skipped it, you're not listening, you're not hearing me anyway, but whatever. I want to thank all the great BOA audio listeners out there. You guys are the best, the fuel that drives the BOA machine. If not for you, there would be no program. Believe me, that is a fact that is not lost on me. So thank you for making BOA Audio a part of your esoteric audio playlist. And until next time, this is Tim Banal, thanking you for listening and signing off.